I'm Michael Polyakov, President of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, and it's my privilege to host this conversation with David Bruce Smith, the founder and president of the Grateful American Foundation, and the author of the new book for children and young adults, Abigail and John, an exciting and wonderful introduction to one of America's most important founding couples. Abigail and John, which we'll talk about today, set an example for the nation and provide a paradigm for young adults as they grow for informed and engaged citizenship. We have with us Julie Silverbrook, the executive director of Consource, an organization devoted to increasing Americans' knowledge of their founding principles and thereby becoming themselves better and more engaged citizens. Julie, David, welcome to this special conversation, which we are proud to host.
Thank you for having us. So I think with that wonderful introduction, I would like to launch right into the conversation. So I consider John and Abigail Adams really America's first power couple. And so I was so pleased to see that you released this book, that you listed Abigail before John in the title, which I think is significant and would like to chat a little bit about. But I want to start out by talking about your decision to launch the Grateful American book series with this book about Abigail and John Adams.
Okay, so I wanted to do a series about presidential or historic couples that were partnerships, because many women in history have not gotten their proper due. Abigail, for example, was partially responsible for John's rise to the White House. He would not have made it without her, because she leveled him off, and she probably was more politically savvy. The same is true with Dolly Madison, for different reasons. James Madison didn't have much of a personality, but she had enough personality for two people. And she is responsible, I believe, for his becoming president.
That's wonderful. So we just discussed another partnership of notable male figure in American history and that person's spouse. I believe that the spouses of the founders actually had a fairly significant role to play in the founding of our nation. And I'm really glad that through this series, you are highlighting that. So what other books do you plan to include in the series? What other power couples do you plan to spotlight?
Well, right now it would be Dolly and James Madison. It's hard to project too far, but the one that comes to mind, and this definitely would not be the third, but because it's too far into the future, but it's definitely a partnership, and that would be Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt. Now, he would have gotten to the White House without her, but he couldn't have stayed there without her, because Eleanor, she was his legs.
Yeah. We often say this, maybe it's a little bit of an old world thing to say nowadays, that behind every great man, there was a great woman. But I do think that today there are more women in power, obviously. But usually behind every great woman, there's also a great man. The people who are able to most succeed usually have a really supportive partner. So I think just at a personal level, that's a wonderful thing to spotlight, that these people are also political leaders, I think is also worth exploring further. They are both political leaders and good people, flawed people.
Right. I think another residual that's working here is, years ago, there was a very popular author by the name of Irving Stone. He wrote about just single people like Michelangelo, but he also wrote about Abigail and John. He wrote about Mary Todd Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln. He wrote about Rachel and Andrew Jackson. And I always thought that the books that encompassed the couples were much more interesting.
I will also just say, as someone who focuses on constitutional history in my own career and what I do, we think it's actually really important to focus on spouses, not just because that relationship is interesting. It's an interesting narrative. It can pull people in, right? Readers in, make it real and tangible to them. But also because that's women had a very small sphere of influence, particularly in early American history. And in exploring these relationships, we're actually getting to see how women within that sphere were able to exert not insignificant political influence over their husbands, who were these great figures. And I think that that narrative is a really important one to highlight. And so I thank you for doing that for young readers. I want to talk a little bit about the research you did for the book to learn more about Abigail and John.
Can I just say one other
yes.
thing? If you were a smart wife like Abigail, maybe you had a small sphere. She made it into a big sphere without anybody knowing.
Right, exactly. So
she was an engineer. I mean, a smart wife is an engineer.
Yeah.
I think.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And isn't that inspiring at a time where, you know, one of her famous quotes is, remember the ladies, when it came to the formation of government, when that wasn't the case. People like Abigail, women like Abigail and Dolly Madison and others, Mercy Otis Warren comes to mind. These women were able to exert pretty significant political influence, and we ought to elevate those voices in mm-hmm. the stories that we tell. So with that, what else did you learn about Abigail and John through your research for this book? Like really interesting tidbits.
Well, besides the fact that it was really an equal partnership, when she says, remember the ladies, the fact that he accepted it. Now, he didn't feel like he was in a position to act on it. But the idea of giving women equal rights was as controversial and as hot as slavery. So he absorbed it and he accepted it. But it didn't happen for 200 years. One of the things that was really interesting about them, I think you have to remember when you're talking history, you're talking his story. So think of it as a gossip session. And there were many stories that revolved around them. There was the two of them, which was they were a little too symbiotic because it affected their children. Two of the boys were alcoholics. So there was a little too much, probably. But there was John Quincy Adams, who became the sixth president. There was Abigail tending the farm for long periods of time without him. They were separated, if you added all the times together, 10 years. During the Revolutionary War, she made bullets and she invested. This was one of the most interesting things. She invested in government bonds. When those were redeemed some years later, she made the family sufficiently wealthy to last for a long time.
So she was a businesswoman, a farmer.
She was
on the vanguard of medical technology. She famously inoculated her children.
Right.
So
right.
She's a really extraordinary woman. One of the things I think that's most extraordinary about what we know of Abigail and John's marriage is we know as much as we do because they didn't actually spend that much of their marriage physically together.
Right.
So we have this amazing correspondence of letters, the exchanging of ideas, the exchanging of love notes, all of these things that we don't have for a lot of other people from that period. So, you know, Martha Washington sort of famously burned a lot of her letters between her and George. And so we lost out on that opportunity. I think we have really, to be honest, probably the best sense of how the Adamses' marriage actually worked because they were apart, and we have these incredible letters, which through the work of the Massachusetts Historical Society and the papers of the Adams family have been preserved and made available to people.
But don't you think it's interesting? 1,000 letters, and they chose not to burn them when the custom was to do it. John Marshall and his wife wrote, because there are only 2 known letters. It's a contradiction of their privacy, but it's also maybe a wish to be remembered. Her letters are considered by some to be the best account of pre- and post-revolutionary America.
It's extraordinary, and I wasn't there when they made the decision not to burn the letters, but you have to think that it was clearly an intentional decision, and, you know, the hope being that this would be preserved for posterity, which is something that John, who was deeply involved in the American Revolution, something he was deeply concerned about. So there's this great quote from him that I'm going to butcher in my paraphrasing, but basically it says, "Posterity, you will never know how much it cost the present generation to earn your freedom, and I hope you will make good use of it," basically. And so John, and really actually a lot of the founding generation, was very concerned about their legacy and preserving that. But the Adams family being unique in wanting to also preserve records of their family life.
That's such a wonderful point. David, I'm glad you really focused on that, that this was something quite unusual. And the correspondence is, in fact, often deeply personal. The first moment that pops into my mind was when, in that unending and vicious scurrility about John Adams, somebody suggested that he was no longer virile. And she wrote back to him, "Well, I would be able to ascertain that you are." And it's a very wonderful, witty reassurance to her husband. And the fact that they wanted to preserve that kind of moment is also deeply revealing. This was a first couple, a paradigm, and perhaps I'm sounding like too much of a romantic traditionalist, but something really wonderful to have an archetypal first couple with that level of sharing and intellect, vibrant exchange, trust, and also deep love and affection, romance for one another. What a wonderful thing, getting back to your book, to share some of this, obviously not those more adult details with young readers, but something that we can all learn from. We've had a few of these sorts of first couple presidencies, and they are an inspiration.
But they had also a very unusual marital philosophy, whereas most couples overlook what they don't like, just ignore it. They chose to just accentuate the similarities. I'd never heard it expressed like that before.
Right. So this book is really extraordinary because it not only teaches you about American history, but perhaps at a time where the institution of marriage is being strained. Divorce is at an all-time high. People are electing not to get married. Maybe this is a really wonderful model, potentially, for people who are thinking about marriage. In fact, when I gave my maid of honor speech at my sister's wedding several years ago, I compared my sister and brother-in-law to John and Abigail Adams and said, you know, I hope that you have a marriage that is as rich and long-lasting as theirs. I do hope you spend more time physically together. But I do think that people see something in this relationship beyond just the, you know, sort of historical information that we can get out of it. Although I do want to turn to that aspect of the book. And, you know, maybe what we'll focus on is how Abigail influenced John's thinking on government, both during the revolution and the periods thereafter.
Well, actually, I don't really think she had much influence. I think he influenced her. She was raised in a very religious home. The whole basis of society was about doing the right thing and religion. It was a bit rigid. So she had her beliefs. I don't think she was an activist about it. But he was actually in public witnessing, you know, the things that were going on, the Townsend Acts and the Boston Tea Party. He kept her informed when he was out in the field, as we would say. And over a period of time, she softened her position and supported his. So I think it was a matter of relying and believing on his intelligence from the field.
That's great. So you, in your research, did you come across any instances where you felt that Abigail maybe softened some of his views or helped him see things in a different way?
Okay, so she senses that war is on the horizon, and she feared it. And she says The sword is now our only yet dreadful alternative. So over time, he convinced her. I mean, the book doesn't go into detail because of the type of book it is. I mean, when you're doing a children's book, my feeling is it's kind of like doing a cooking reduction. You have to make it as simple as possible. And, you know, when I write something that I don't understand, I just throw it out and start over. So you can't think like an adult.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, though, the challenges of presenting. It's a long marriage. There's a lot of material to sift through because we have so many of their letters. Talk about the process that you went through to write the book, to present this in a way that's really compelling for young people. And by the way, it's a little bit long for a 16-month-old, but I did read the whole thing to my 16-month-old nephew, and he especially loved the pictures, which I know that your mom did the illustrations, but he's read quite a bit about the founding period. He was engaged with this one, and so even though it's a little bit long for his attention span, he liked it.
The illustrations definitely have to move the story.
Yeah,
I mean, it's nice that the text and the illustrations work, but depending on the age group, the illustrations have to create kind of like an attractive nuisance, and that's through the illustration.
Right. And then in thinking about how you select what you're going to highlight versus what you're not going to highlight within the book, you can't cover everything.
Right.
Because otherwise it would be too long, no longer considered a children's book. Take us through that process. How do you make this decision? Yeah, I wouldn't imagine it is.
Not easy. So normally what I do is I read mostly children's books, and then I'll read a little bit of more adult books. But when I start reading adult books, it confuses me because then I can't get the voice properly.
Right.
The problem with most children's books is, for example, when we were working on the John Marshall book, and there wasn't much about him in for children a few years ago. The situation is, you know, he's born, he decides to have X career, he rises quickly, he becomes famous, and he dies. Where are the problems?
Right.
I mean, so we did not want to have a flat book like that. So we did this for the John Marshall Foundation, and I wanted to say, for example, Polly Marshall, his wife, was very depressed because they lost 4 children. And when she was in Yorktown as a girl, she became hard of hearing. And the theory was she got tinnitus from, you know, all the gunfire and the cannon and stuff like that. Some of that we were forced to take out. I thought it was a mistake because, you know, you can present stuff to kids in an age-appropriate way. So we didn't have flexibility, really. I mean, some of the stuff stayed in, but this book, it wasn't an issue. So if you read the book, you know that it wasn't always great. I think it's important that kids know that.
And let's talk a little bit about that, right? So John is a popular figure coming out of the Revolution. He's not at the Constitutional Convention. He's representing the new nation abroad at that time. And then he gets selected to be vice president, and things start to get difficult for him. Can you talk us through that period in John's life up through his presidency?
Well, he hated being vice president, as most vice presidents up to Mondale hated the job. He said the position was not adapted to my character, too inactive, mechanical. He attended a few cabinet meetings, and in March of 1789, and then George Washington didn't really want his counsel, and he just thought it was a useless, useless invention by mankind. John Nance Garner, who was FDR's vice president from 33 to 41, used saltier language, but believed it wasn't worth it. Just wasn't worth it. I mean, how many vice presidents do you remember?
Very few, right?
Typically the ones who through politics or tragedy become president.
Right.
Yes.
But John does become president.
Right.
And his presidency perhaps does not proceed the way that he had hoped. Indeed, it's his role in the Alien and Sedition Acts that he actually thinks will taint his entire reputation, that it doesn't matter all of the good things he did during the revolution. That's all people are going to remember. And there's probably some truth in that, although I think David McCullough's book on John Adams, which became an HBO miniseries, there's been some rehabilitation of John Adams more recently. And actually, there's a number of biographies of Adams that have come out recently and are scheduled to come out over the next couple of years. So this book comes out at a really good time for folks who are interested in rehabbing Adams's reputation, which really was sullied by the Alien and Sedition Acts.
But the interesting thing about that, I just learned this, was he wasn't really in favor of passing those acts. It was Abigail and the cabinet who pressed him to do it. He really did not have, one of your questions is, what's his legislative legacy?
Right.
He didn't have one
until
the John Adams book by McCullough. I mean, I don't think, people knew he was the second president, but that's it. He was like Chester Alan Arthur, you know, just obscure.
Yeah.
But I hope another aspect of his presidency that will come to the fore is his virtually heroic rejection of his own and his party's interest and his focus on being the president of the United States above party. And John Quincy picked up much of that. And it is perhaps not coincidental that both of them were one-term presidents. But I'm hoping that especially after this era of hyper-partisanship, dangerous partisanship, we'll begin to look back on a president who was able to be self-sacrificing, who was able to look beyond his own interests, his own party interests, to think about what it meant to be the leader of the nation. So many of our leaders pay rhetorical homage to that principle, but how many have actually been able to do it? And even in that, you know, often cited instance of his purported party interest with the midnight appointments, there were judges who were from the other party in that mix. I really want to focus on something that we as Americans can take away from this remarkable presidency.
But there were actually three big things that he did. He's considered the father of the Navy. He signed the legislation for the Library of Congress. And he kept the peace during the quasi-war with France.
Which is significant.
Yes.
I think a lot of people don't appreciate actually how tenuous things were after the Constitution was signed and we had this new national government. I think people just assume it was kind of smooth sailing from there to the Civil War. We had the British sort of out to the west. They still had encampments there and in Canada. We, of course, end up having the War of 1812, which is really, to be honest, sort of the end of the American Revolution. And you have France, again, kind of trying to exert its foreign influence. So there's some things to learn about foreign influence in American politics if you look in the early republic. It was a very real threat then, and I think that's an important thing. So I think there's so many analogies between what's happening now, what happened then, and can we bottle up some of the virtue that was shown by great leaders and somehow encapsulate that and use that to teach a new generation of citizens and political leaders to put the nation ahead of party, ahead of self. That's really significant, and I think that's something that would really resonate with people in this day and age.
But there are parallels that are exactly the same. George Bush, the father, tried to do the right thing, and he lost.
Yes. Yes.
So it's unfortunate, you know? I'm not comparing John Adams to George Bush. I'm just the situation, the intention was the same.
And I think that's another important reason to study history is to see the analogs, to see how things were resolved, to maybe get some insight into the better or more correct path to take, especially at this moment. Because, Michael, I think you hit the nail on the head. This is a hyper-polarized moment in American history. And how do we overcome it? Not that things weren't polarized back then, though. I mean, it was quite political. I mean, you know,
pretty vicious.
Yeah, the election of 1800, you know, was quite vicious. John Adams was burned in effigy. So, you know, that's not to say that partisanship was not a concern here, but just that there were key figures who helped overcome that to actually do the things that needed to get done.
Okay, so if it's true that there's a dearth of historical knowledge, let's just say for kids at the moment, let's say that, you know, the numbers are bad. But if you think of history as stories, the numbers that you get are not accurate because Ancestry.com is huge.
Yep.
23andMe is huge. Now, that might be your history, but it's history, and it's a starting point.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I gave a talk maybe 2 months ago where I talked about this interest in ancestry and tracing your family lineage. And the argument for doing that is I can't understand who I am if I don't understand my history. Well, you can't understand where the nation is today, who we are as a country, if you don't understand American history. It's the same thing. And so for me, I think when you can make history more personal to people, they become more interested in it. So I have, you know, to anyone who will listen, if you are interested in Ancestry.com and 23andMe, I swear to you, you will also become very interested in American history because it's the same thing. That's the DNA of America. You want to understand who you are as a citizen, who we are as a nation. You got to dive deep into that. And it can be as rich and interesting, and in some cases more rich and interesting than your own personal history.
ACTA was honored in 2016, privileged to have with us historian Neil Ferguson as our Merrill Award winner, the Merrill Prize for Outstanding Contributions to Liberal Education. And Ferguson stressed the philosophy of R.G. Collingswood, an important historian, a philosopher of history, the 20th century, in reminding us that the only real reason for studying history is the lens that it gives us to understand present action. This is something that, Julie, you're absolutely correct about. We can live more wisely, make better decisions, if we'll take up that idea of applied history, not history for the fun of it, although it is a lot of fun, as you said, David. It is his story and her story. These are things that are inherently interesting, but there's a great urgency about it. You may have noticed sitting in this room that of the books that ACTA keeps out on the shelves, as many of them are devoted to American history as are devoted to education policy, because this is so crucial to the education of future citizens and leaders. And pulling ourselves, as we're doing now, back to that recognition that our future depends on our understanding of the past and our willingness to understand the mistakes and the successes. This is something that is central mission for any educator.
And you have to start them young. That's why books like this are so important. You know, my love of American history came from things that my parents did with us when we were kids. Books that we read, experiences that we had. I grew up in a little town called Washington Crossing in Pennsylvania. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's where Washington crossed the Delaware River to fight the Battle of Trenton. They attempt a crossing every winter. Unlike Washington, they have a choice if it's too treacherous, it's too much liability. They don't actually cross. My parents would bundle us up and take us to the reenactment. And growing up in the Philadelphia area, there's history all around you. But those stories became my story, right? The American history really became a part of who I am. And that's because we started young. So children's books like this are so critically important. And I'm fairly active on social media. And I have a list of children's books about American history that I recommend. This is now on it. You'd be shocked by the number. If when I say, is anybody out there interested in history books for kids, the number of responses I get that said, yes, please, I'd love to know really good books that I can give to my to read with my young child with so that we can help them learn more about their nation's history. It's just as important in some ways as learning this is mom, this is dad, this is great grandma, this was great grandmother's letter, this is John Adams, this is Abigail Adams, this is Dolly and James Madison, and to learn their role, because where we are in this moment is impacted not just by the decision of your parents, great-grandparents, great-grandparents, but what these people did as well. That's a huge part of our legacy. And these kinds of young interventions, early interventions for young citizens, I think are absolutely critical. And so I'm so glad you're launching this series. And I'm very much so looking forward to seeing what other books come out of it.
I should mention that we have a wonderful ally. David's organization gives an annual book prize, the Grateful American Book Prize. And this year it went to Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who has committed herself to the same cause. It's just another reminder that great leaders all understand, whatever party they may come from, that our engagement with our past, our understanding of it, is an essential part of having a future that is a successful future.
I think it's just extraordinary. Justice Sotomayor has written a book for both a children's book and a sort of teenager book, in addition to the one that she wrote for adults. She's actively involved in iCivics, which is an organization that we're very proud to partner with very often. Justice Neil Gorsuch is now the honorary chair at the National Constitution Center. And of course, Justice O'Connor started iCivics.
Yeah.
So the leaders in the legal field, but leaders of government, right, are recognizing and have recognized in the case of Justice O'Connor for a decade that civic and history education are foundational, and we need to invest in it, and that both is sort of, you know, big picture kind of change in the schools, in colleges and universities, and I know this is something that ACTA is concerned with, but also starts at home, right? Parents are our first teachers, right? And these books give parents the tools to start teaching their children about the history of their nation, to give them that piece of their DNA, right?
I want to focus on one of the little warnings of history, too, that came up when I heard that we were going to have this wonderful conversation. I thought it was time to go back to David McCullough's wonderful book and refresh my memory. And I came upon this particular moment, which I hadn't focused on before. In the back and forth about the Alien and Sedition Acts, Noah Webster, I'm quoting here from David McCullough's book, editor, author, lexicographer, and staunch Federalist, declared it time to stop newspaper editors from libeling those with whom they disagreed. And I thought to myself, the irony of a figure who so renowned in American letters and lexicography and journalism would have made that error, of course, understandable when people are frightened, as happens when war is about to break out, they sometimes waver from their principles. And it is a warning to us today. It's so easy to fall into that mentality. The same thing happened in 1918. I think Woodrow Wilson has gotten a little pass in history for that one, his strong embrace of the Sedition Act, or what was it called then? It was the Espionage and Sedition Act.
That's correct.
I believe. And, of course, the wonderful thing about a free society is the way that it does ultimately correct itself, as Justice Holmes moved from the Schenck position, that there was a clear and present danger, to his dissent in Abrams, upholding the idea of the free marketplace of ideas. So here we are again at one of these moments when we tend to be hearing a lot about a lot of disquieting talk of repressing viewpoints, that we have this paradigm from history.
So one of the reasons why Adams lost and why John Quincy lost, Jefferson had a lot of friends who were newspaper owners, and he squeezed them to retaliate in any way they could. So, I mean, they used their platform as a way to make Adams look worse.
It is never easy in a free society. That is one of the great lessons of history. And being able to stop ourselves and ask, is this really what we want to do? Is this true to our principles, founding principles? That's the great difficult task. And it can be very, very daunting. One of our speakers a couple of years ago at ACTA's annual conference was Nadine Strossen, the past president of the ACLU. And as you recall, Nadine, who is herself the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, was the one who argued passionately for the right of the American Nazi Party to hold a demonstration, a parade through Skokie, where so many survivors of the Holocaust lived. And whether one agrees or not with the position, the heroism in sticking to principle in those circumstances is something that we can all benefit from.
I think that's absolutely right. And that's why these kinds of narrative accounts are so powerful. This is sort of a broader look at Abigail and John, and I think that that's equally important. But in some instances, there's a deeper dive into a particular moment, a difficult moment in their lives where they were tested. And sometimes they failed, right, according to modern standards or even contemporary standards, the standards at the time. And sometimes they rose above, and those stories are inspirational. And the privilege of knowing Nadine, and I think that that's a wonderful example of a person who had every personal reason to oppose that march and to put restrictions on speech, but based on principle, decided not to do that. And she got a lot of pushback for it. ACLU lost a lot of members after that decision. And so it's difficult to make decisions on principle, I think, especially in this day and age where you can be shouted down so quickly on social media. But to have the courage of your convictions and to have leaders both more recent and much further in the past who can show you the way and can show you that it's worth it to you, perhaps in the long run, if not the short run, to have the courage of your convictions, that's incredibly inspirational for young people.
It really is. And she did the right thing. I have no doubt her stomach was in knots, as mine was when we wrote to the University of Wyoming saying that they had to honor the invitation to Bill Ayers, the former weatherman, to give a presentation. But it is by doing things like that that we solidify our grasp on core freedoms and that ability unblinkingly, unwaveringly to hew true to principle. Is something that we do need to celebrate. I know we've gotten a little bit off topic
that's
here.
But I feel like that's a beautiful point to end on, though.
I am so grateful to you. I am, dare I say, a grateful American for the Grateful American Foundation.
Yep, wonderful.
Thank you.